that you're going to mouth the phone.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So we want to talk about working and playing well with others, because that's something that as alcoholics I think we struggle with. You know, and again, like, you know, these go back to the principles and the things that we find in the lost chapters, and taking the information that we got when we did our inventories. You know, when it says that, you know, perhaps there was a better way, what is that? You know, and one of the things that I found with people that I work with is, like, they know what a better way, like the words, they know the catchphrases, you know, love and tolerance is our code. You know, perhaps, you know, they know these things, but they don't really know what love and tolerance looks like.
Mm.
And again, you know, alcoholics, we're very visual people, and I think that, you know, more than anything else, we learn by other people's example when we see what these spiritual principles look like when they're in action in other people's lives. And again, that's why sponsorships is so incredibly important. Why it's so incredibly important to have people in your life who are doing the deal, you know, and have that, you know, creating that fellowship that we crave. Because, you know, we watch other people deal with or go through things or apply these principles in certain circumstances, and we can extrapolate and apply them to ourselves, you know. But, I mean, one of the things that I have run into in all of these years are people, like I said, is they know what the right thing is to say. They know what to write on the paper, but they don't know what these principles look like. I mean, what does it look like to be patient and tolerant? What does it look like to have compassion? What does it look like to be unselfish? What does it look like to be honest? You know, what do these things look like in our lives and in our relationships? One of the baffling and bizarre things about alcoholism, and untreated alcoholism, is half the time when we're being dishonest, we're not even aware of it. You know, so I mean, like, I don't know how many times, like, an absolute and utter lie came out of my mouth, and it was like, only later I was like, that so wasn't true. Why the hell did I say that? I mean, and so, like, you know, I mean, but the outright, you know, lie of commission, you know, it's relatively easy for us to recognize. But what about the lies of omission? And one of the things that that my sponsor definitely had me work with was emotional honesty. You know, I've been talking a lot about this weekend about how our feelings are not facts. That I might feel something, but it doesn't make that a reality. And the difference between, and really what we're talking about, the difference between objective and subjective truth. You know, the objective truth being the overall truth with a capital T, and subjective truth being our own personal truths. And there can be things that are overall overreaching principles that are common things that we share as part of our personal realities. And they can still be a part of the objective truth, but our subjective truth are our personal experiences. And we experience the objective truth with a capital T through the filter of our personal experiences being our subjective truth. So when I'm communicating with somebody or somebody's communicating with me, we're communicating in terms of our personal filters or our subjective truths. You know, so... And it's something that's actually DeMello, love DeMello. DeMello talks about this, you know, the I'm an ass, you're an ass concept, which I love to work with. But also this idea, if, you know, somebody walked up to me and said I had blonde hair, right? I would think to myself, I'm like, no, auburn, you know, like I guess this person is colorblind, or maybe this person has a different label for blonde than I do. But I wouldn't be offended by it because I know it not to be true. And somebody comes up to me and says, you're stupid and fat. Stupid, I probably wouldn't be offended by, but fat, I totally would be. You know, because there's some part of me that fears that that might be true, or believes on some level that it's possible that that's true. Now, objectively, I know that that's not true. But subjectively, I do. Or I believe that it's possible that it's true, and then I get offended, and I take ownership of that. Because my personal filter is agreeing with theirs. You understand what I'm saying? So part of how we learn to work and play well with others is to identify our personal filters, our worldview that colors our perspective, so that we can recognize when that filter is coloring our objective truth. You understand what I'm talking about? So, like...
One, go, go. Sorry.
No, no.
I was going to say, is the process that we go through.
I told you I was smart, by the way.
The process that we go through in the steps, and you know, we talked a lot about this weekend, and we're talking about it outside and different ways to go through this and everything like that. And you know, I believe in a brand new guy, you know, rocket him through. Use the book, do the deal. But if we've got this spiritual experience kind of behind us, and we've recovered from alcoholism, we can start playing with the stuff that this book teaches us, and kind of tweaking it a little bit to suit what goes on in our lives. And that's part of the reason that I really like, I don't know how you guys do your fear inventory down here, but my four column fear inventory isn't technically specifically directed in the book. It's in there and you can kind of manipulate it a little bit, but it's there. No, it's not. It doesn't tell you to write the third and the fourth column.
It asks you the questions.
But what I've done is I've changed the words around, and part of the reason for that is I want to see what it looks like in my life. You know, why these things are going down. How do I set the ball rolling? Okay? It doesn't ask me that question in the book, but if I ask myself that question, I can look at what it looks like to be in fear. How does it manifest in my day? Because fear is a kind of almost intangible thing. It's something that's twirling around in your head, but what do I do? What are the actions I take? And then there's the line after that. It says, you know, perhaps there is a better way. Well, what perhaps is a better way? And I tell every single one of my sponsees, and I do this myself, is you cannot put the words trust God in that column.
Because that's a given.
It's a given. It's a cop-out. What does it look like to trust God in this scenario? What do I do in my daily life that shows that I'm trusting God?
So one of the things that I work with, and one of the things that I've had people do over the years, is taking page 52. Everybody knows about taking 52 and writing on your bedevilments, right? You take a look at all the bedevilments and you write where they're manifesting, or if they're manifesting in your life. But what if you took all the bedevilments, you wrote where they were manifesting in your life, and then you created a vision of what your life would look like if you weren't doing that?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm having trouble with my personal relationships. I write where I'm having trouble with my personal relationships very specifically. So then I go into meditation and I ask God, God, what would it look like if Carrie wasn't having trouble in her personal relationships? And then I write that vision of what the opposite of that bedevilment is, specifically based on what I wrote on how it's manifesting. So Say I'm having trouble with coworkers. Like I'm a snark and a gossip, right? Try very hard not to gossip. I work in an industry where everybody throws everybody under the bus. I mean, like, bus throwing is like our favorite pastime, and nobody ever does anything right, you know. Never. So like, it's sort of a pastime at my job for like people to sit around in the office when we change shifts, and part of shift report is to discuss how everybody else sucks but you. And so I don't really participate in that. I really don't. I have at times slipped into that and pulled right back out of it going, whoa, don't. And I said, you know what, I'm sorry. The truth is I'm being unreasonable. And I'll slip right back into the objective truth as opposed to my subjective truth. But this is a thing in my job, and we all do this because we're all like, you know, demigods in our own little world, and nobody is as good at what we do as we are. And there's a huge competitiveness that goes on too. And so I'll be sitting around at work and I'll see this going on, and I may not be verbalizing it, but I'm thinking it. I'm thinking at them. I'm listening. I'm comparing. I'm doing all of these things. So when I'm sitting and I'm looking at those bedevilments and I'm saying, where am I having trouble in my personal relationships? Well, at work. I have judgment. I think I'm better than other people. I play the spiritual person and I don't say it, but I think that because I don't say it, it makes me better than them. You know, and I do all, you know, and I'll write that out. What does that look like? And so what's the opposite of that? You know, okay, so yeah, bring love and compassion, but what does love and compassion look like? For example, I work with somebody who's very racist, and he uses a word that makes me want to vomit. Now, I've politely asked him not to use it. Now, I can't make him not use it, and I also don't want to make a hostile work environment. So when he uses this word that makes me want to vomit, I try to envision him encapsulated with God's love and grace. I visualize him surrounded by God's love and grace. I visualize myself surrounded by God's love and grace, and it just goes right through me. I don't react to it, and I don't have judgment. It's just a word he's using. I preferred he use something else. God bless him. It's gone. Now, if I sat in judgment and I tried to change him, or I judged him for his perspective, I don't agree with it. In fact, I abhor it. But if I sat there and I created an identity of me being superior to him because of this shortcoming he has, I'm, one, not having any compassion. I'm not having any love. I'm not participating in a recovery. And the thing is when I visualize this and I don't react to this word, he stops using it. Because he's not getting what he wants out of me. He's not getting an agreement nor an acknowledgement that it was spoken. Because I don't hear the word. I hear it and it goes through me. And I don't even react to it. And whatever comment he makes surrounding this word, I didn't hear that either. It just doesn't blip on my radar. He stopped using it. When I would make a face, he got a reaction, so he used it. I don't make anything. I'm calm as a Hindu cow. And nothing happens. So that, when we're talking about, you know, love and tolerance, you know, love and tolerance of our is our code. Love and tolerance is our code. What does that mean? And sometimes that means doing some spiritual work, such as you doing what I just told you was called the love light meditation, by the way. And it's just a visualization that we use when we have somebody who we view as being in need of God's love and grace, who maybe is not awake to the God within them. I mean, when we say namaste was up on the board, and as the intent of namaste is basically the divine in me greets the divine within you. So, you know, it's that, and I think that actually, when I, and this is again, Merton, and it's also Emmett Fox. You know, the idea that there's a spark of the divine that dwells within me, there's a spark in the divine that dwells within you, it dwells within all of us. So when I'm interacting with you, I try to pay attention to that fact. So when I'm interacting with you, I'm trying to see that within you. I'm trying to make a communion between the divine within me and the divine within you. And I might even think to myself, namaste. You know, there's certain things that we do or we can do to sort of bring about. We want to bring about an environment of recovery and hope. And we're not, and like I said, this is why we said it's not just, service is not just about drunks and newcomers and detoxes in the big book. But where can I bring this holistic perspective other places? Where can I, you know, I don't want to be four different people in four different situations. Mm-hmm. What I want to do is be able to be the same person everywhere. I'm the person you've seen at this table making cracks about porn and all the other things. It's the same person I am at home. I mean, that's kind of the point. When I do this stuff, I don't, when I do these workshops, when I speak from the podium, I don't have a podium persona. This is my podium persona. Sorry, but this is what it is. You know, but that's the same person you're going to get on the telephone with the 10-step. That's the same person you're going to get when you're sitting across the table reading the big book. It's the same person you're going to get when we're hanging out, like just bugging out on something stupid or going for a hike or any of those other things. People know what they're going to get from me because I'm consistent. Mm-hmm. I don't wear a different face for different circumstances. I bring me, who I am, warts and all. And one, it makes people feel a lot better about themselves because, like, dude, she's way fucked up. But also part of it is then, you know, with that sense of comfort and who I am and what I do and being that without an apology, because I'm an ass, you're an ass, people feel more comfortable with being themselves. And it's amazing how other people's walls go down when my walls don't exist. Does that make sense to you? You know, so how do we not build those walls? What is it that we can do as individuals to be more effective in all the areas of our life, by being more authentic in who we are. You know, what does that authenticity look like for you? And that's what I was saying. What is your vision? Who do you want to be? You have a chance to recreate your life. We have it. We don't. And I'm not talking about dictating to God to be a demigod or be important or any of those other things. But we have an opportunity for God to recreate our life, and we do have a say and somewhat as to how who we end up being. I remember when I first started doing this work, and I was working, or not even when I first started. When I really became like, you know, a thorough big book Nazi. You know, I was in the Spiritual Awakenings group, and it was like full of, you know, Dave and Chris, and, you know, Mark was coming out, and we had all these influences and all these people, and it was just like we were all like in a crazy, on fire, thumping, fire and brimstone big book thumpers. And I kind of looked around at all of us, and I'm like, we're all assholes. Seriously, like, you know, people would be coming into the meeting and be like, you know, and they would just be saying the most sanctimonious crap.
You ever go to a meeting that we used to call them doom and gloom meetings? Okay, and you go into a meeting and somebody asks for a topic and somebody brings up this horrible tragedy that went down or whatever. And then the next person shares about something even worse. And the next person shares about something even worse. And it's like this one-ups on how fucked up our lives are. Well, at the Spiritual Awakenings group, we had the same concept, except who does better meditation? Who does it longer? Who does it in what way? And who has this better teacher? And you know what?
I read 37 spiritual books before I got up for breakfast, and therefore I am much more spiritual than you.
Yeah. And it didn't start out that way. It didn't start out that way. It started out as this drive to learn about this message and to carry this message and to help people, and somewhere along the way we got caught up in that guru thing, you know, and we're all these little mini gurus, and we're all got plans, and we're going to change Alcoholics Anonymous, yes. You know, and we're making this big revolution, and you know what? We got to change.
Yeah.
And then it follows.
Yeah.
It happens on its own.
So, you know, like, and so, like, we, you know, we got sanctimonious and, mm-hmm. and so spiritual that, you know, like, we farted, you know, fucking fairy dust, man. Seriously. And the thing was, it was like, it was awesome, and everybody, we all go through this phase. I mean, you guys have all gone through it, I'm sure. You know? And then you kind of come back to reality. There's this book, it's called After the Ecstasy, Then the Laundry.
Yes.
And it's all about having profound spiritual experiences and then just finding yourself in the modern world looking around going, so that was it. Okay. You know, so how do I take this profound spiritual experience and go to the supermarket, you know, do the laundry, function in the modern world, you know, because we all glimpsed God. If you're sitting here and you haven't had a drink and you have recovered, then you have felt the power of God. You felt the hand of God come inside of you and switch something on. You felt it. You felt the flow. You know it.
Now it's time to do the dishes.
Yeah, exactly. So we're walking through this. We're walking in this around this earth with this incredible experience and connection, with this incredible knowledge, with this the knowledge that this thing, that something like that could exist.
Mm-hmm.
And we're walking around, and we're, you know, just going about our lives. And how do we do that? How do we do that without becoming so, without creating an identity around that? And that's really what we're talking about, is that not creating an attachment to being awake, but experience being awake, and being experiencing being awake is enough. That being awake in itself is enough, that I don't need to be so attached to my awareness that it becomes an encumberment. You know what I'm saying? You know, and so I was looking around this meeting, and I'm looking around, and like there, and everybody's competitive, and who's got more sponsees? Who wrote the longer inventory? Who meditates more? Who does this? Who's got more detox commitments? And they're like, they're whipping their dicks out left and right. It's a man's meeting. I was like the only girl. I was like the only girl to do the extended third and fourth column inventory, like, for years. you know. And it's like, if there was anybody who needed to do it, it's like, oh, damn it, Carrie's the only girl who knows how to do it. So send it to her. So, I mean, this was the deal. So, like, I'm looking around and I'm thinking to myself, and this guy's saying, I haven't thought about a woman sexually, and I haven't objectified her in 6 months. And I'm like, you're boring. Really? And that's where I thought about it. And I said, you know, I'm not going to do this. You know, I came in here a tattooed-covered, mohawk-wearing, freaking knife-carrying punk rock chick with, you know, Doc Martens. And I still wear Docs, by the way. You know, I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to create an idea of what a spiritual person looks like and try to fit myself into this idea, because I'm going to be so attached to this idea that I'm going to lose sight of the whole point, which is the authenticity of this. If I get people to work with me because I talk like a truck driver and I'm nuts, and they love that. The most prim and proper woman will be like, yes, you said it, I thought it, this girl's got balls. And the guys are like, holy shit, she talks like me, awesome. You know, but, and that's kind of how it goes. I mean, this is, and the thing is like, and that's me. Who are you? What is going to be your flavor? What is going to be your approach? We don't have to be spiritual robots to be effective in Alcoholics Anonymous in our lives. What we need to be is who God made us, and embrace that. Now, that's not an excuse to do terrible things. God made me a pervert, so therefore I'm going to be one. No. You know. But what I'm saying is that we don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater to be spiritual beings. That's not what we're talking about. And I think for a long time, there were these people that I absolutely adored, I worshipped. I created an idol out of them because they knew this book backwards and forwards in a way that I still to this day wish I could. I'm catching up. But, you know, I still got a couple more decades till I'm like them. And people do it to me, honestly. I don't know how many times people have listened to a talk that I've given on CD or whatever, and they're like, oh, you know, when are you going to be in my area, my state? And I'm like, oh, you know, I'm going to be in, you know, Seattle and blah, blah, blah. So, you know what, why don't you, I'm going to speak in this day. Why don't you come out and meet me? And they come in and their face falls. They're like, you're Carrie. You sure? Carrie from XA? Oh, shit. Damn it. You know, I just see the disappointment. I think it's hilarious because I'm like, would you expect a statuesque blonde and, you know, in a business suit? Did you listen to my fucking story?
A monk.
You know, really? You know?
Don't we all got to be monks?
And so, you know, when we're talking about working and playing well with others, part of it is learning to work and play well with ourselves in the spiritual sense. Clarify that. As part of it is accepting, I mean, when we take our seventh step, and we ask God to take all of us good and bad, right? And we go out and we make our amends, and we're living in 10, 11, and 12, and we redress and go through the work when it's necessary to have more of our channels cleared, so to speak. You know, we're asking God to do something for us, right? We're asking God to make us in the way that, you know, it says, you know, build with me and do with me as thou wilt. It means I don't get to decide what I look like anymore. I don't get to decide who I become. I allow God to do that. I mean, I have a certain responsibility to show up and do a certain amount of work. And God does listen to us. And this is the beautiful thing, is what I want doesn't matter. Doesn't mean that God doesn't love me enough to hear what I want or allow me to ask. He's just allowed to say no. You know, that was something else I had to learn, was that it's okay to say to God, you know what, I don't like this. And God says, so? But you know, my kids say they don't like shit all the time. I got four of them, so I have four separate opinions on a regular basis. You know, and I love it, as much as it might annoy me when I get the no. You know, I also, like, I love when they come up with their crazy opinions, when they entertain me with their ideas and their plans and their designs. And they're kind of, you know, my four-year-old is coming up saying all kinds of craziness to me, and I think it's hilarious. It amuses me. So is it possible that I amuse God? with my crazy plans and designs? Does God not love me enough to hear me out, even if the answer is going to be no or not now? You know, so, I mean, there's that part, too. So, we get to ask, we get to communicate, but we also get to give up the control and allow us to become what we were intended to be in the first place. I mean, because that's what I really think is going on here, is that, you know, we were supposed to be a certain way, and for whatever reason, because of alcoholism, whether we were, you know, freeze-dried alcoholic, crossed the line, I don't know, and I really don't care. I don't really, that's a debate that's somewhat irrelevant because you are an alcoholic, so just deal with it. Who cares how the fuck you got here? Mm-hmm. But, you know, so ultimately, you know, it's like however you got here, however you came upon this disease, there was somebody that you were meant to be in the first place. And we got derailed through our alcoholism. And our job from this point, when it says to broaden and deepen, to grow in understanding and effectiveness, is to embrace and become that person. You know, and that for each one of us is somebody different. Mm-hmm. That all of our paths are, we apply all of these principles. And we use very, you know, a lot of the same techniques and mechanics in applying these principles, but the principles express themselves in each one of us in an individualistic way. This is the difference between the objective truth and the subjective truth. The objective truth being the 12 steps, and the subjective truth being our own personal results. Is this making sense to you? Did you have something?
No. You're doing great, and I'm just enjoying it myself.
Sorry.
I just the only thing I wanted to touch on with this stuff is for me the, like I said, was the inventory process helped that, and the ideals. You know, my sex ideal is not only a sex ideal; it's relationship ideals and who I want to be. And I apply those same principles and tweak them just a little bit in those same practices to become who I need to be. You know, to get that vision, because I didn't know who I was supposed to be. You know, I didn't know what was right or wrong, or, you know, inside of me there was something there, but I could never word it. I could never define it. I didn't know what it looked like, and it took practice, and it took sitting down and actually doing it and asking God to show me. The problem, or the difference, I don't want to say it's a problem because it's not, it actually works fine. The difference between me and her, she's very eloquent. She's got a way of using the language, and she can express things in words that I never could. I still can't. You know, I'm a show me guy. You know, I don't give you this long, you know, really, you know, profound word definition of something. I invite you over. Let's hang out.
And he gets to see, and then people get to see him tolerate my insanity, and they're like, dude,
he's insane. You want to go for a ride? I gotta make a run to Newark Airport. You know, you got some inventory? Let's go. You know, and I bring them into my life, and I show them how I live, and because I don't know how to express some of these things. I'm not the word guy, you know. So, you know, for those of you who are similar to me, you know, bring them along, invite them into your world, show them how you live, and yeah, you can answer the questions and you can explain it on a situational basis on how this happened. You know, but I can't bring into my consciousness how I did the past 18 years. There's, you know, I could tell you how I crossed the street and didn't, you know, and didn't bitch at that lady who cut me off. You know, I know how to deal with individual situations. You know, so for me, it was all about bringing people along, showing them what I did, doing the writing and the meditation so that I could see what it looked like, mm-hmm. and not being afraid to ask questions. Not being able to, you know, find people that we respect and we admire and that have something that we want in their lives, and ask them how you did it. You know, what do you think? But the other, the warning in that is what they say isn't gospel. If it resonates true, cool. If it doesn't, it doesn't have to be mine.
You talked about the ideal, and over the years I've done many different types of ideals. Of course, we've all done the sex ideal. You know, I mean, that's kind of a given.
Hopefully.
Yeah, if you haven't,
do it.
Get with me later and I'll explain it to you. But you know, the same ideal or the same structure I've used for sponsorship. You know, for myself, what kind of sponsor do I want to be? It's a relationship. Let me bring that to the table. Who do I want to be in the sponsor-sponsee relationship? And for me, it wasn't about controlling or patrolling my sponsees. I don't do that. I don't drama manage. It was about setting an example, being of service, being honest, being compassionate. You know, and it's, you know, it talks about it in the doctor's opinion. It says that, you know, that we have, our message has to have depth and weight, right? Depth meaning a solution or and an answer, and the weight is the willingness to assist with that. I mean, it's one thing to tell somebody they have a problem or even give them instructions and, well, here's your problem, this is how you fix it, see you later, you know, let me know how that works out for you. No. You know, we participate. It's collaborative. You know, because this is the fellowship of the Spirit. And it is about collaboration. And that's where, you know, alcoholics, we don't do well at. I mean, think about this. Who here has been gone to college? Okay. How many, you know, you ever do like a group project, you know, and like when your professor decides that they were reading Piaget or some crap and they decided that they were going to try some sort of, like constructive method of instruction, right? And they decide, we're going to do a group project. Let's do a group project where we all break up into groups and then we present this to the class and we do whatever. And did it suck? Did you hate doing group projects? Were you the one who just said, look, people, just do, here, look, you write this, just give it to me and I'll fix it and I'll hand it in and we'll get an A because I can't trust you with my grade. Do that. I did that. I was notorious, by the way, for that. Everybody wanted to be in my group because nobody had to do any work. And they would get an A. Yeah. So, I mean, so we don't necessarily do collaborative well. I mean, this is definitely something I'm working on. You know, and we don't do communication well. And again, this is we're talking about creating this ideal and saying, okay, well, you know, how can I be a more collaborative human being within the constraints of my personality and identity? Some of us are more fiercely independent and some of us are much more laid back and easygoing and social than I am. You know, so, I mean, he's great at that. And a lot of times I'll defer to him. Like, when there's something going on, some sort of family thing, my family thing, or something we got to organize, I get all the shit together, and I get the schedule, and I book everything, and he deals with everything else. Because I don't do that well. I bark. I bark orders. You go here, you go this, and then people want to smack me. I know that about myself, so I don't do it.
He organizes the list.
Yes, and I delegate the things that I'm not great at, so I don't cause harm. You know, so I mean, part of it is about, you know, is about recognizing where we're not great. Now, you know, and we do get better with these things. I bark far less than I used to, you know, but it's saying, okay, I'm not great at this, but somebody else is. Can I not bring them into this, and can we not work together? But see, ego's a motherfucker, man. Mm-hmm. I want to do everything perfect all the time and never admit that there are things that I don't do great. I have to be great at everything and I can never let you know that I'm not. Well, everybody knows that you're not anyway. You're not fooling anybody. So, you know, just acknowledging, admitting, and accepting the collaboration between the individuals works so much better than trying to force yourself to be something that you're not, pretending that you're something you're not, or just harming other people because you're being you. You know? And so, I mean, part of it is really that, but it's creating that vision. What do I look like as a sponsor? What do I look like as an employee? What do I look like as an employer? What do I look like here? I'm a writer. I've written for years. It was something I stopped doing. And it's something that, in meditation, it was something that we were talking about potential. You know, and in meditation, I'm like, people hate me. People hate me for a lot of reasons. People really hate me for this, though, because I'm in graduate school. I do shit. I barely do the reading. I'll write a paper. I have a paper due tonight. I'm going to write it on the plane, and I'll get an A. I'll spend an hour. I'll write an 8-page paper, and I'll get an A. I spent 2 hours last weekend writing a paper, a 12-page paper, and I got 100 out of 100 points, and my professor praised the living shit out of it, and it was all bullshit. I wrote it in about an hour and 15, maybe an hour and 30 minutes, you know. I'm an asshole. You know, I had that kind of brain. So I'm a writer. I've always been a writer. I pull this shit out of my ass, and my professors think that I walk on water, and I laugh to myself thinking, really? Your standards are really fucking low, man. But as it was coming to me in meditation, it was something that kept coming to me, and it was like, you know, I have this talent, and I don't use it. How selfish am I? I can pull a research project out of my behind. I'm articulate when I feel like it. When not every other word that comes out of my mouth is an F-bomb, I'm rather articulate. And I have this talent, and I haven't been using it because I'm lazy. Because it's always been there. So when I want to pick it up, I can do it again, right? And it came to me in meditation. Actually, I was meditating before I went to work, and I was driving. I have an hour commute there, an hour commute home, and I drive. I go to work. I work 4 to 12, or 4:30 to 12:30. And I get out of work sometimes closer to 1. So between 1 o'clock and 2 o'clock in the morning, nobody's up, you know, unless I'm going to call, you know, California or Texas with a 10-step because I'm being stupid. But other than that, no one's up. You know, so I have an hour of quiet driving home, and it occurred to me, like, you haven't been writing. You haven't written in years. You haven't written anything creative. What a selfish prick you are. Maybe you need to start doing this again. And it kept coming to me again and again, again and again. And I'm like, there's something to this. So I started writing again. Just for the pure joy of writing. You know, so, I mean, like, you know, it sounds like something really stupid, you know, but... And then you think, it's like, okay, graduate school, full-time employment, 4 children, 10 sponsees, and, you know, and I take about a weekend a month and go somewhere else and give these talks and do these things. Where do I have time to do that? There's always time to do things if you want it enough. There's always opportunities to, you know, to do things if we want it enough. If we prioritize properly, and that's one of the things that, again, alcoholics, we're not great at, prioritizing. You ever just sit down and make a list of the things that are important to you in your life, the things that you need to prioritize? You ever do that? Again, this is something, you know, it sounds so stupid and cliche, but something we don't do that we really should, and I have, and I was made to do it. You know, is to look at what relationships are the most important relationships in my life. What are my priorities? And unfortunately, and Adam knows this, he's the fifth on my list because I have 4 children. It's God, AA, 4 children, him. He's the first adult on my list. And he knows this, and he's accepted this, and I think if it was any other way, you would be unhappy about that, correct?
It's all good.
Yeah. But, you know, I had to sit down. What are the most important things? What are the most important things to me? What are activities or things that I value? What do I value? You know, because I've heard so many times people say, well, I want to do this, and I really, really this, and I think it's really important, but their actions, their feet say it's not. My 4 steps really important to me. My recovery is really important to me. When was the last time you wrote on it? Last week. No, it's not important to you. Mm-hmm. Well, but I just watched the entire season of Mad Men. I guess Mad Men's more important to you than your recovery, dude. I don't know what the fuck to tell you. But, I mean, these are things that we need to think about. Like, and one of the things that I did was not necessarily look at what I thought, but look at what I did. What do my actions tell me are important? You know, my actions tell me what's important in my life, that my children are the most important thing to me. Because I work like a dog just to make sure that they're provided for. Plus, when I'm not working like a dog, I'm snuggling them and spending time with them and actually doing things like playing Uno and red light, green light, and having conversations with them. Oh, my God. You know, sponsorship is incredibly important to me because when I'm not sleeping, working, or with my children, that is what I'm doing. I mean, I've seen 4 movies this year. You know, not at home, but I mean out. Like, I've gone to the movie theater 4 times this year.
Yeah, that many?
Yeah.
Wow.
Exactly. You know, I'm doing 12-step work. That's what I'm doing. Then it's the other stuff. Then it's yoga. Then it's exercise. Then it's this. Then it's that. But my actions show what I value. Don't, it's not what we're thinking, what we value. Look at what your feet are doing. What are you valuing in your life? And if you're giving time to something that isn't something you value, stop it. Stop it. I'm not a prissy girl. My nails are painted only because I came here. I mean, at any given point, you'll see like nail polish that's only like 2 drops because I painted it a month ago and I'm just too lazy to take it off. You know? I am not the type of woman, like my eyebrows, I do not get my eyebrows waxed because I'm fucking lazy. I don't have time to do that. I don't have time for pedicures. I don't value those things. I don't value my appearance. In fact, I try very hard not to have an identity associated with my appearance because women, we create this idea that we're supposed to be young and beautiful all the time, right? And guess what? You get old. And you get fat. And you get stretch marks and your boobs sag. And what's going to happen? Well, you're either going to hate yourself or you're going to get with the program. And so one of the things that I do, people tell me that I'm beautiful. I say, thank you, but I try not to be attached to that. Because one day, I'm not going to be. One day, I'm going to be old, and I'm going to have my tattoos are going to be wrinkly. And if I'm attached to being attractive, I'm screwed. And I'm good.
Wrap it up
really quick. And this is just a funny story. I was working with this guy, Rob, and he was, I went through this really, really intense step process where I looked at all of these values and I had it. It was very something very similar to what you were talking about, Tarek. You know, where you had to write out all these things. What do I really give time to? And you kind of looked at it, like, you know, and not just from a mental perspective. So in this process, I got pregnant and I call up my sponsor crying because I'm going to get fat because when you get pregnant, you get fat and then you got to lose the weight and losing the weight sucks, right? And I'm crying, and I'm at this point, like, I'm, like, 28 years old, and, like, a size zero, you know. I'm, like, one of those skinny bitches that everybody hates, you know, who, you know, you just hate me, you know, because I pumped out 2 kids, and, you know, I'm a size zero, and you want to smack me. So I call him up crying because I'm going to be fat, and I don't want to lose the weight, and I'm going to have to do all this stuff, and I'm crying, and I'm being all attached to my external. And he was like, one, he told me, oh, my God, he was like, he ripped me a new one about how vain and everything I was. And he was absolutely right. You know, and then he says to me, he goes, you know what, I hope you never lose the baby weight. I hope you never do. He's like, I hope you never get that skinny again. And he's like, because if you do, you're just going to create another identity about it. And you're going to be such an evil, vain, egotistical bitch. I hope you never do. So, a year and a half later, I get into that one pair of jeans that tells you you're not fat anymore, and I found out I was pregnant again. I have since donated those jeans to the Sally, and I have accepted, and I don't want to be the type of person that has to do those types of things to fit in those jeans anymore because I don't value it. He broke me of that. I don't value it. It doesn't matter to me. I stopped being attached to how I looked. It doesn't matter. I like looking good, and I like being pretty. But if I wasn't anymore, it would be okay. So we have to look at what we value, you know, and really look at it. So are we good for now? Mm-hmm. Want to do take a break and then do the...
What was next?
Questions? Just roll into the Q&A and then do cool. The raffle. And
okay, cool.
Sounds good.
I'm going to
get a longer break before lunch.
Sounds
cool.
Good.
So, okay, so we're going to do Q&A. Who's got what?
I've got a question.
Sure.
You guys were talking, like, one thing I do with the people I've sponsored in the past is we look at ourselves using the circle triangle,
yep.
Where we are in step work, home mm-hmm. group, commitments, with the fellowship, and who are we taking through the steps.
Mm-hmm.
And then I really like what you guys did this morning about the service piece, and you know, it's not just about, you know, it talks about especially alcoholics in the original manuscript. And, do you differentiate? Do you call one service the fellowship, and then you've got this service that the, you know, I don't know when Bill came up with the three legacies that he defines as anything that makes carrying the message possible.
Mm-hmm.
But the big book only talks about one form of service.
Yes.
And then we've got outside of this, we have service to other areas. You know, mm-hmm. what are we, like, Dave's big thing is hospice work.
Yes.
Know, pushed it down my throat. And, you know, I'm in the process of getting registered to do that because mm-hmm. he says it will be a good effect
mm-hmm.
in my life. And, you know, where do you differentiate that with new people you're taking to the session? When they show up to my house, I'm looking at sponsorship.
Yes.
That's it.
Yeah. Yes.
When it comes to new people, you know, and people just fresh, yeah, absolutely. Get them entrenched in working with others. Get them entrenched with being part of AA. In my life, there's no difference because both of them happen. You know, they both become part of my everyday activity. Yeah. I don't do a hospice thing or any, like, organized service outside. I do what we do. We live this, and we're part of the community in that respect. My neighbors talk to my neighbors about recovery. You know, I used to shovel my neighbor's driveway as an act. And when I was first learning this, you know, learning how to be part of the community, I'd sneak out at 6:30 in the morning and shovel their driveway. You know, and they'd wake up and not know what happened. You know, stuff like that. That's how I got started. And that's one of the first things that I do outside of working with others. And I tell my newcomer guys that are caught up in selfishness and they're trying to find a way to be of service to people, is secretly do something.
Yeah, it's actually in the Just for Today. That's also an Al-Anon thing. In Al-Anon, they have you do three anonymous unselfish acts a day. But and I don't differentiate either. Only newcomers, again, we want them firmly entrenched in AA, and we want them in that circle and triangle here. And typically, I mean, I was raised, like, my parents are incredible human beings. I was raised in a family where it was expected. I mean, every Saturday morning we went to the soup kitchen that was run by the Carmelite nuns, and I was expected, no matter how hungover I was, to go. I was expected to work in the homeless shelter that my parish sponsored. I was expected to make baskets for the old people and pick their asses up and help bring them to the Mass of the Anointing. So I grew up in a family where community service was a huge aspect of who we are. And I still do a ton of it. Ton of it. You know, and again, it's, you know, you know, it's about finding what your niche is. I have sponsees who are fantastic with their own personal step work. They carry a decent message. They're not really great. They're not great with working with newcomers as well. They do it because they have to, but they're fantastic in service. They work great in committees. They volunteer and they work, you know, in outreach and committees and doing these things. And they're phenomenal in that aspect. And I'm like, look, as long as you're carrying a message and carrying a message of Alcoholics Anonymous and working with newcomers, if you have three sponsees instead of 10 like me, but you're in a committee and you're doing days of sharing and things like that that are helping to bring speakers in to carry a big book message, but awesome. That's service. So I think we also have to find what fits us best. You know, I mean, we're supposed to be carrying a message, yes, and we are supposed to be sponsoring, because sponsorship is part of our spiritual experience. But when it comes to service, you know, within Alcoholics Anonymous and outside of it, you know, we find what fits us, and we work with who we are. And, you know, it could be, you know, visiting people in an old home. It could be working at a rummage sale in your church. Whatever that service is, you know. Does that make sense to you?
Absolutely.
And inside AA, you know, a lot of us want to, you know, we got these service opportunities. And, like, she was just saying something
about DCM
about workshops and things like that, though. And yeah, the DCM, the GSRs, all that stuff. But the workshop stuff, I'm not a planner. I'm not the guy who's able to be the secretary or do any of that stuff, but that's okay. I'm the mule. You know, I got a pickup. You need 20 cases of soda brought down to the convention, call Adam.
Yeah,
you know,
I made him do that.
Because that's actually what I do. You know, that's still service. That's still part of the deal. I may not be part of the making this thing, you know, all hashing out the details of what how it's going to go or this, but you know what, I got a truck, you know, I can bring supplies, and that's still a valuable part, because you need somebody to do that shit. You know, it may not be glamorous, but you know what, it does the deal.
They're the more important people, by the way, because none of us would be comfortable or have soda or water or any of those things without the people who do that. And it's typically the people who are up front who get all the credit, and the people who are behind the scenes who get... And those are the people who are the most important part of these mm-hmm. things. You know, and often we forget it, the people who make things like this possible because of their effort and energy.
Typically, you know, not even the actor, I'm the stagehand.
Yeah. Any other questions? Sure.
I think your relationship, how it started and where you've progressed, yeah. is bizarre, really.
Yes, absolutely.
And you made a reference to talking about the working your traditions and your relationship, but I think that probably most of us either are in a relationship or will be at some point. Mm-hmm. Just try to understand how you guys do that interaction.
Well, when we were talking about ground rules and figuring out how to fight, those are things from when we talked about ground rules. When we said, like, when we set boundaries and ground rules, what's acceptable, not acceptable. For example, like, there are certain things that I used to use the word moron all the time. And it was just like, my family uses it. Like, I grew up hearing, oh, you're a moron. And see, that doesn't offend me. I'd be like, yeah. And he, oh my God, it really offended him. And we sat down. We had a group conscience with our relationship. And he's like, look, that one phrase really bothers me. Can you not use it? I was like, okay, sure. Boom, did. So we have group consciences. You know, we have righted decision. Like, we agreed with our money. Like, we have a cap. And if you spend over this amount, you need to call your spouse. You know, we basically took the 12 traditions, we took the principles from these traditions, and we have votes. We have votes in our household, our children have a vote. We have, collaboration. You know, so we do all of these things. You have any other?
No, you're doing good.
Like, we set the ground rules. We sat down and hashed out the ground rules for, like, for example, like 12-step work and what constitutes what we're going to allow in our house. But it was all of us sitting down, having a group conscience, and discussing what worked and didn't work, what we wanted and didn't want. You know, so we have that all. We have a group conscience. What?
Miss your book.
Oh my God. We have a group conscience, like, a couple times a week, where he and I sit down and we talk about how the week's been running, how our jobs have been running, how the kids have been running, how the school has been running, what we need to change, what we can do better, what we can do differently, and we collaborate. And we have one, like, usually it's on the phone when he's coming from work and I'm going to work. And we sit down and we talk about, like, what's up? Where are we falling short? What could we be doing different? How can we amend this? Where could we change? Yeah. Yeah, when I wake him up, you know. So we do that. What are some of the other traditions that we directly apply?
Well, and this is, I was just going to throw this out there. And you can find, it's a really useful resource, a woman named Mary Pearl. Mary Pearl is this black belt Al-Anon from,
love that,
from Arkansas or Alabama or something like that. But she's on XA and she's got a whole workshop based on this concept.
Dave App also has quite a bit of stuff on traditions and relationships.
And the actual simple breakdown of the way it's worded for the traditions and the concept is in the FOTS handouts.
Yeah. The Fellowship of the Spirit, David Marks, 2001.
Yeah, David Marks FOTS handouts has the same things. But it's something very simple, like our common welfare should come first.
Personal
recovery
depends on
the family
unity. And also, there's a converse thing, too, is that personal recovery depends on AA unity, and AA unity depends on personal recovery, because if we don't have personal recovery, if we're not recovered, we're not bringing recovered spirits to AA, and therefore we don't have unity. So part of the thing with our traditions and relationships is that both of us are responsible to attend to our personal recovery and maintain our recovered state so we can have family unity. Mm-hmm. Make sense?
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's very simple. It really is. Because the theory behind it is really basic. You know, we're some of the craziest people on the planet. We come from all different walks of life. And then we sit in a room and we get along to a certain degree. You know what I mean? You know, mostly. We're thrown into this circle. And we wouldn't, a lot of us would never intermingle. But we get along mostly. You know, imagine a group of people that actually want to be together. Well, you know, using those same principles, it makes things amazing. It really does.
So, I mean, some of it is pretty simple, and we already do it. Like, you know, like I said, it's like we have a commitment to maintain our spiritual relation, our spiritual condition. Mm-hmm. And my spiritual condition, you know, I make an agreement for that. We make an agreement for that. We both hold ourselves and each other accountable for maintaining our spiritual condition.
That's actually another thing too that kind of applies to what you're asking, and we do we have ground rules set aside, and
we agreed how to fight.
Yeah, we agree, but we also
no fighting in a moving car ever.
Yeah, but we also
no arguing in a moving car.
We also agreed on how to call each other on shit. You know what I mean? Because I'm allowed to call her on her stuff when she's acting out and she's doing something fucked up, and the same goes for her to me. But there's a certain way to do it.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a certain way to approach her and tell her I need to speak to her about this.
Like, for example, you'll just say something really, really simple is, did you eat? Because if I'm not eating, I'm running like a crazy person in like my manic mode. He stops and says, you know, instead he's like, you're running around with chicken around head, blah, 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 blah. And I don't hear that. I hear, wah, 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 wah. He just stops me and goes, did you eat? No. I should probably sit down and take a minute. Something that simple. You know? That simple. Like, but he knows that that works with me because we've talked about it. We talked about what are the things, what are the behaviors that Carrie exhibits when Carrie is not living on a spiritual basis and she's running on self-will. One of the things that happens when that happens is I stop sleeping and I stop eating because I'm so busy doing. You know, so for him, he'll say, did you nap today? Did you eat? And what he's really asking me is, are you taking care of your spiritual condition? Are you taking care of your physical condition? You know? And it's just that, so like calling me on it and being like, you're trying to, you know, hump everything into submission doesn't work. But if you ask me that simple question, it stops me in my tracks. I hear it when he says it.
A lot of times in that kind of a scenario, what I'll do is I'll grab the kids and I'll run errands. But I'll say it prior to, you know, that, you know what, you know, have you napped? You seem tired. I'm going to take the kids.
Yep.
And I run down to Walmart just to grab milk. You know, just to kill.
Because he knows
the
if they're
time.
There, I'm not going to sleep.
If they're there, she's not going to go in her room and veg out. If we come back and she's in the room, I can direct them outside. She can do what she needs to do. But if I go in and say, you know, you're being fucked up, you're acting like a dick, you know, that doesn't work.
And on the other hand, like last weekend, we were running a bunch of errands. We hit the ground on Saturday, and we had 10,000 things to do. And I got called into work early 2 days in a row, and I didn't get to actually do any yoga, or I didn't get to go for a run before I go to work. And this is really physically and spiritually very important to me. So I hit the ground Saturday. I get up from work, and I'm like, I really need to go for a run, or I need to do some yoga. And he's like, well, we have this to do. Can you do it when we come back? I'm like, well, not really, because I'm gonna be a bitch. I really am. I didn't do what I physically needed to do for myself. I'm off. And he's like, well, I'll take that chance. We came home and he's like, yeah, never again. Never again. Carrying Walmart without having done yoga for 3 days is not a very pretty sight. No. But I asked for what I needed.
And the thing was, too, though, is I signed up for that and I wasn't allowed to really get pissed.
Yeah. But we communicated. He was like, look, we really need to get this done now. He's like, I'll deal with you being cranky. And he's like, and when we get home, I'll make sure that you get the opportunity to take care of what you need to. And that's exactly what he did. We communicated. And so when I was being short, he knew I wasn't being short because I was mad at him. He knew I was being short because literally I was withdrawing off of my endorphins is what I was doing. And I needed, yeah, exactly.
Exactly.
You know, so like things like that those simple communications. I mean, I think really, you know, throughout the weekend we've been talking about what this looks like, but I guess we didn't specifically say this is this tradition. For example, another one is that, you know, when it talks about we have service boards and committees directly responsible to those they serve, we delegate responsibility. He's terrible with numbers and paying bills and remembering to do stuff like that. I'm great at it. I'm good with the money. Before I started wrangling psychotics, I worked in business and did accounting. So that's what I do. I take care of that stuff. On the other hand, I hate dealing with doctors and crap on the phone. If I have to make those stupid phone calls to the doctor or sit on hold for 30 minutes while trying to talk to the insurance company, I fucking hate it. He does that. Because he's got the patience to do that. I don't. I'm going 75 miles an hour. I don't have time to be on the phone. He'll be driving in his truck, picking up wood, doing whatever, and he'll be on the phone trying to, you know, talk to, you know, whatever it is that we need to deal with. So he does that because I'm not good at it. We delegate. He has roles and things that he does. I have roles that I do. We don't cross the streams. I try hard not to step micro, and I don't micromanage. I'll say, what was it a couple weeks ago? Dave needed an eye doctor appointment. There was a couple like things that like phone work that needed to be done. I gave him a list. I said, because he won't know what needs to be done. I have to give him the list because that's my job to know what needs to be done. And it's his job to do it. Because, you know, if I say, oh, by the way, he won't remember it. So I make the list. Eye doctor appointment, we had Rowan needed paperwork for the doctor,
right,
a couple things, and I said, look, I don't have time to do this. Here's a list of stuff. Can you take care of this? Meanwhile, I was running around taking care of like crap for like house, that running 10 different errands and my responsibilities. I gave him that list. I didn't ask when the eye doctor appointment was. He did it. It was on the calendar. I didn't micromanage him. I didn't tell him when he should make the eye doctor appointment. It was his responsibility. He had right a decision. He was responsible to those he served, my daughter. He took care of it. It was none of my business.
No.
Make sense?
And just for your own, you know, growth process and all that shit, this doesn't happen overnight. It really doesn't. You know, we didn't wake up one day and are like this. You know what I mean? This is years of
wearing each other down,
fighting against the tide. You know, because she was talking about not micromanaging for years. Did you do that? Did you do that? Did you do that?
Type A personality.
And yes, she's absolutely right. She doesn't micromanage my jobs today. But it took a long time, you know. And the money thing, you know, it's like I used to hold all the money, but I'd fuck it up. But I gotta do it. But I forget. Yeah. You know?
You forget to pay the car insurance. And then, like, he'd be walking around with, like, $3,000 in his pocket. And I'd be like, the cable's off. What the hell? I forgot to pay it.
So, you know, it takes time, and it takes really. The key word with all of this relationship crap is communication.
Yeah.
Being able to talk to each other about stuff. You know, and not being afraid of what you're saying.
Yeah.
And say it right.
Yeah. Yes, mean what you say what you mean, but don't say it mean. You know, and that's the other thing, is stop being so fucking vague. We beat around the bush.
Yes, thank you.
We're telegraphing shit. Say it. You know, and you know what, and if you can't say it, If you're afraid you won't be able to say it in a nice way, here's what you do. I have something to say to you. It's really important to me. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to articulate this properly. I apologize in advance if it offends you, and I'm certainly willing to hear whatever you have to say about this, but it's really important for me to say it to you. So I'm really sorry in advance. You're an asshole. You know?
But exactly, and this is why. And you know what? I'd rather that. I really do. And this was a conversation that we had. I wanted her to do that. I do not, you know, I don't know if this is a guy thing or just the density of me, but I don't get subtlety.
Oh, God, no.
I do not understand subtle. Tell me what you mean. You know what I mean?
And then when I tell him what I mean, he goes, well, what do you mean by that? I'm like, I just said it! Very clearly!
Do not be vague.
I don't understand! I'm like, what the fuck don't you understand? What do you mean? I mean, really, looks at me blankly. I mean, I'll be like, very specific, type A personality, detailed, reasoned argument. Like, you know, because this is me, a reasoned argument, a thesis on exactly why something needs to be a certain way. Honey, we need to address A, B, and C. Here are the reasons why I think this needs to be addressed, and here are alternatives that I think would work instead of that. very clearly, 6 points laid out, well-reasoned argument. I don't understand. So then I repeat it, because I think repeating it is what's going to make him understand.
Make sure
you're
loud.
So then I go, okay.
Make sure you slam that.
Exactly. So then I'm like, okay, let me repeat this well-reasoned argument once again. So then I repeat it word for word, and he just sits there and he goes, "What? But I don't understand." So then I go, "Well, what don't you understand? Anything?" What do you mean you don't understand anything? What were you talking about? I'm like, oh, fuck. And then, so this is what, but here's where the other thing, it says into the wives, it says this is, the conversation's getting heated. Because now I'm ready to put his head through the wall. Because I had this well-reasoned argument that I took into meditation, did 10 steps on, sat with my sponsor, came up with this whole if-then scenario thing, right? And I've done this thesis. And he stares at me blankly. This is 10 man hours on this fucking thing. And this is where, honey, obviously we're not communicating at this moment. Can we? Why don't we take a break and come back to this later? It's getting heated because I'm going to murder you. And we take a step back and hit. And then like a couple hours later, he'll be like, "I think I know what you were talking about. Did you mean this? Eureka!" But sometimes when somebody's just staring at you, willing you to understand, you just go blank. You're like a deer in the headlights, and you're just like, what? You know, so this amazing thing. We could step away from a conversation. We've revisited the same conversation 4 times. You know, like just like in a business meeting, we make it all business. We say, okay, we're going to table that and talk about it at the next business meeting. We do the same thing. We're going to table that. Because sometimes we don't have an answer. Sometimes there's just something going on in our lives and there's no answer to it, you know. It just is. And there's nothing we can really do to fix it except for pay attention to it and be aware of it and be awake to it. I mean, we have a daughter. She's 17. God, I love her to death. But she's also, she's ADD and she's got my personality. So she's like really histrionic and annoying. And I love her. She's the coolest kid ever. She's like an artist, and she's freaky, and she's got red Rihanna red hair, and she wears black all the time, and black eyeliner, and listens to like Blood on the Dance Floor. I mean, she's like the coolest kid in the world. But she's my kid, so she's weird, you know. And she'll come to us with this thing, you know, and we'd just be sitting there going, "I don't know, man. Like, I just don't know." Like, she doesn't do well in school because she's ADD, and she's just like one of those kids. She's very, very smart, but she's not a great student. And we don't have an answer for that except for, like, let's just get you out of high school. You know, she got the accommodations. We fought for that. It took 4 years of school for us to get her the accommodations, the ADHD diagnosis, and get this kid the help that she needed. But we fought for it the entire time. You know, and then now that she's got it, you know, she'd come and I would sit with her and I'd be like, "You need to do your homework," and I would stand over her like an overlord. I stopped doing that. Because you know what? At the time she was 16 years old, she's gonna do her homework or she's not. But I'm gonna make her hate me if I stand over her shoulder. You know what? If she stays back, that's a natural consequences of her actions. I get natural consequences for my actions. She needs her own. I stopped giving her consequences. I allowed her to have her own consequences. And guess what? She didn't stay back, but she damn near did. And all the teachers said, "Wow, she really is ADHD. Let's get her some accommodations." I had to be willing to look like a bad parent for a few minutes to have a kid who didn't hand in her homework in order to allow her to get the help she needed. I kept helping her so much, I wasn't allowing her to get the real help, because it was it reflected badly on me if I had a kid who stayed back. I had to put aside my ego and let her have the consequences, the natural consequences that she needed for her to get what she needed. And I had to stop making her life about me. But we sat there. We didn't have an answer. We kept tabling it and tabling it and tabling it until we finally said, "The only thing we can do is let her be who she is, and whatever happens, happens. I love my kid. She stays back, she stays back. So what?" Mm-hmm. We let it happen. It got addressed. We tabled that issue how many times?
I don't even know.
We would just...
It's forever.
We stared at each other blankly.
It's been going on forever.
You know? I think we have time for like one quick one.
I have a question.
Sure.
You know, in the amends process, one of the last things you say is, what can I do to make this right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I had to be careful about that because some of the amends that I and my sponsees have to make were to sick people. And like mm-hmm. my ex-husband I did that with.
Mm-hmm.
He thought I owed him $10,000 for damages, you know, for I didn't owe him any money. He owed me, but... Anyway, I was thinking of $10,000 because he thought I deprived him of the lifestyle he became accustomed to, and I should pay him $10,000 for that because I wanted the divorce.
Mm-hmm.
It's just sometimes I feel like you have to be careful
mm-hmm.
who you say that to.
Well, you can ask that question, but you don't always have to do what they request. A perfect example.
I was told to basically say I'll bring this up with my spiritual advisor and I'll get back to you.
Yeah. I went and made amends to an old home group. There is I always end up in a home group with people who sleep with men who sleep with their sponsees. I don't really know why that is, but it seems to be like I always end up in one of those groups. You know, because I think there's just a lot of them. So there was a group out. There was a group in New York that had this habit of the men sponsoring the women and accidentally sleeping with them. And the person who was bringing me through the work at the time hit on me and tried to sleep with me. I was 19, almost 20 years old. And I freaked out, of course, because I'd just been through steps 1, 2, and 3. I was starting 4. I'm going to die an alcoholic death if I don't have this. And the person who was bringing me through the steps just made a huge pass at me. And I'm so young, I don't know how to deal with that. So I just clammed up and pretended it didn't happen, came home and cried. And I was crying hysterically. Adam had no idea what happened because I was going to say, I'm going to die an alcoholic death and I have no bank book and I'm going to die. And he's like, what the fuck happened? So he gets it out of me, what happened? I mean, and he made a serious, like, swoop in, hand on the thigh, gross, disgusting, dirty old man pass. It wasn't a subtle one. And he calls his sponsor, who had just done attended a workshop with Wally P. and did Back to Basics. His sponsor, his old sponsor, mails me a shoebox full of Joe and Charlie and Back to Basics and all the handouts and said, just do a fifth step with a woman, just do what you got to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the first time I went through the work, was with my best friend. We sat down with Joe and Charlie and paused it and did it and paused it and did it and finished the work. So I copped such a huge resentment against this group. I walked I went around everywhere and told everybody that they were D-bags, this and blah, 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 that. I trashed them. I would steal women out of there. I mean, I was on a mission to steal women out of that group. I did everything possible. Every meeting you brought up their name, I hissed. So I was told I owed an amends. So I went back to this group and I made a direct amends to the group, and I raised my hand in the meeting and I stood up and I explained. I didn't say why I trashed them because that would be causing a harm. But I explained that I had a resentment and what I did, and you know, and I asked what I could do to set it right. And the person who started the meeting came up to me after the meeting and said, well, as he's looking at me, I was wearing a skirt and a tank top. And as he leers at me with that look and the licking his chops, he goes, I'd like you to go through the steps with me and come out to this meeting for 90 days and attend this meeting every day. And I look at Adam, and because we came in separate. We separate when we go to meetings because we like to do the 1-2 punch. And I look at him, and I'm like, and I said to him exactly that. I said, you know what? I'm going to take that into prayer and meditation, and you know, and I'll let you know. You'll know if I take you up on that if I come back. I didn't go back. I didn't do it. You know, because he wanted to give me a spiritual awakening through injection. I wasn't all that keen for it, but I asked, I got something, I took it into meditation, God said no. So it's not a dictation, but if it's something that's reasonable, we need to do it.
But yeah, exactly. And part of the reason for asking that question, though, is because, you know, I don't always know how I harm people. I don't always know what it is specifically that I've done to them And so by giving them the opportunity to talk about this stuff, and, you know, I had a sponsee who I got to make amends, I got to make amends, I owe this guy $20, I owe this guy $20, I got to make amends. And I said, well, let's talk about it. And I said, well, what happened? Well, I was on this run, and I went to his house, and I borrowed $20 from him, and you know, I need to pay this back, and blah, blah, blah. He's my you know, couple door down neighbor. And I was like, yeah, when did you do that? Oh, it was 3 or 4 a.m. the other night. He's got a family? Oh, yeah, he's got kids. The lights went on, and everybody was up. And it's like, oh, so your amend is that you want to pay him $20. That's what he thought he owed the amends for. And my view, and I'm sure the homeowner's view, was that the harm wasn't the $20. The harm was the
banging on the door.
Banging on their door at 4 o'clock in the morning, waking up his kids and freaking his family out. You know, this spun out crackhead showing up at his doorstep in the middle of the night. You know, that's the harm. And unless we talk to people about what we're doing, and the other individual too, because I, as a sponsor, can only give you insight on what you're telling me. I can't jump in the mind of the person who it happened to and understand it from their perspective. I can try to a certain degree, but I can only work within the framework that you allow me to by telling me what you know. You know, so talking to that person and asking them to talk, you know, tell you what's going on and how this affected them and what you can do to set this right is really insightful sometimes. You know, sometimes it's clear and cut. I owe them $20. I got to pay the money back. But sometimes it's not. Yeah. You know, sometimes there's that emotional security issue. Yeah. You know, a lot of us like to forget about how we rob emotional security from people.
Or sometimes they're going to give you something like my principal gave me that changed my life and made me the person I am today.
Mm-hmm.
And I would never, if I didn't make that amend and if I didn't ask that question, I wouldn't have gotten that directive, and I wouldn't be sitting here.
And what they tell you is not necessarily mandated down from God. You know, it's not. You know, we speak to our sponsors. We bring the information and we tell them what they said. And you know, I brought stuff to my sponsor and said, he told me to do this. He goes, "What are you, fucking nuts?" You know,
yeah.
No. You know, you can, if you wanna do something to set this right, go do this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And you're cool. You know, because what this guy's saying is totally insane.
Yeah. Any other questions? Are we just about done?
Yeah. Everybody give Adam a hand. Raffle time.
Nice.
Oh.